All right. The next speaker is Jeremy Taylor. He's a Unitarian minister. He's the dream missionary to the world. Most of you know him, and if you don't, you'll know him after this. Okay.
Thank you, Joyce. My understanding is that this is a group of people with a scattering of folks who know about Tibetan Buddhism and a bunch of people who don't. So let me start with a quick characterization. It seems to me that one of the things worth knowing is that the Buddha was, in fact, in this level of historicity, a Hindu trying to reform Hinduism. And there was no separate Buddhist religion until after he died. And his followers were unable to retain the rapprochement with the Hindu establishment, so they had to set up their own administration. You could say exactly the same thing about Jesus. Jesus was a Jew trying to reform Judaism. And there was no separate Christianity until Jesus' brother, James the Just, got into a fight with the chief rabbi of Jerusalem and set up his own shop. I say that because there is a kind of exclusivist, triumphalist thread in the Christian movement which separates us from the world. And no matter how much lip service we pay to universal humanity, the focus is on the Christian tradition and not much else. And I would like to try and at least open a threshold to another perspective which resonates at the same level of archetypal truth in my experience that Christianity does. Tibet has always been the mysterious place beyond the horizon that nobody could get to. The death knell of Tibet has been the completion of the railway from Beijing to Lhasa. Tibet is no longer cut off from the world. You can buy a train ticket and go. And one of the things the Chinese are doing is sending excess population to Tibet, so there will be no Tibetan people anymore. From this position of isolation, the Tibetans, prior to the arrival of the Buddhist missionary, were a shamanic people. They had evolved into a medieval sort of structure where the great wealthy families had their own personal shamans, but it was still shamanic. The connection between individual human life and the divine was mediated by people with skill in going into trance. And they believed very deeply in reincarnation. And they believed very deeply that the dream world was more real than the waking physical world. Along comes the Buddhist missionary, and he converses with the king and says, you know, you really ought to wake up and get a broader view of the world and not just listen to your ancestors mumbling through this intermediary shaman person. You ought to get with it. And the king says, who are you to say that to me? Get out of here. And the missionary exerts powers of mind and causes the king's breath to stop. He cannot breathe. And because he can't breathe, he can't speak. So he gets more and more agitated, and the courtiers around him don't know what's going on. And finally, he comes upon the archetypal metaphor of throwing in the towel. And he grabs the white silk scarf off his neck and offers it to the minister, the missionary, and falls to his knees. And the missionary allows him to breathe again. That's the mythological slash historical story behind this habit of giving white scarves to Tibetan Buddhist officials. One of the times when it was my honor to be in the presence of the Dalai Lama, people were thrusting these white scarves on him, and he was taking them, saying thanks a lot, and passing them on to his entourage. And it was clear to me that nobody who was giving him a white scarf had the faintest idea, consciously, what it meant. And it meant, I give up. I cannot speak in the presence of the power that you represent. Now, I find that a kind of ugly metaphor myself. There's the Romans converting the world to Christianity at the point of a sword. And there's the Buddhists converting the world to Buddhism using strangling powers of mind. Certain fundamental archetypal similarity here. And Tibetan culture makes the leap from archaic shamanism to sophisticated Buddhism in one jump, in one generation. There isn't an evolution from the shaman position to the organized religion position to larger and larger visions. It goes boom. And one of the consequences of that is that the entire body of shamanic wisdom gets translated into the Buddhist context whole. And the people who were the religious professionals prior to the arrival of the missionary become the new religious professionals, having familiarized themselves with the Buddhist texts. Now, because of this shamanic background, the Tibetans already believed that what happens when we die is that life energy separates from the physical form and enters what we would all recognize as the dream world. Only unlike dreaming while we are embodied, where we dream and we wake up and then we go to sleep and dream again, and occasionally the dream intrudes into our waking lives in the form of vision and whatnot. Unlike that sort of rhythmic spiral experience of the dream when we are embodied, the dream becomes the totality of reality for us. And the Tibetan Buddhists have this very interesting idea of what that means. They say that means that every individual person experiences the way we experience the manifest content of our dream, whatever afterlife their previous embodied existence has prepared them to expect. So it's not a question of somebody being right about what happens after you die and everybody else being wrong. Everybody's right. If I am a white bread Christian, I get on the golden elevator and get off on a cloud and get issued with a halo and a harp. And if I am a passionate believing Catholic, I get picked up in the whirlwind and introduced to the community of saints. And if I am a Pure Land Buddhist, I join the swirling crowds around Mount Sumeru singing the praises of Amitabha Buddha. And that's what happens. That's the manifest content of the dream. So it isn't like there's one afterlife. Everyone's afterlife is created by what they have been prepared to expect, both consciously and unconsciously. It isn't a question of conscious belief. It's a question of the relationship between conscious belief and what are essentially the archetypal forms. So the Buddhists say that goes on for 40 days. And at the end of the 40 days, the sun sets and the leaves fall off the trees and the fountains dry up and the food starts to rot and the musicians go home and monsters appear. And the monsters are like the monstrous figures in our nightmares. They are projections. They are symbolic representations of our unlived, unexpressed life. And depending on how bad they are, how frightening and horrifying they are, the discarnate 40-day dead person begins to flee through this decaying nightmare landscape until the idea forms in the consciousness of the fleeing entity that the only way to get relief from this horrible pursuit is to slip in between two beings as they are copulating. And depending on how bad the monsters are, we may not even hold out for human beings. We may slip in between the first pair of armadillos that we see, and bam, we're back on the wheel as armadillos. Now, if we are believing Hindus, the surface manifest content of the dream is that we appear before the lords of karma and they unroll a scroll and go, "Oh, Jeremy, you've been really bad. You misled thousands of people while you were alive. You come back as a cockroach," and bam, I'm a cockroach. But the Tibetans point out that, like the dream, it appears to be a set of external events that are inflicted upon the consciousness of the discarnate being, but in fact, it's all unconsciously self-inflicted. Because the Tibetans know that everything in the dream while we are awake and everything in the dream after we die is a projection, a symbolic mirror reflection of aspects of the dreamer's own being, the dreamer's own psyche. So it's all self-inflicted. The fleeing entity doesn't know that it's self-inflicted, but it is. So the Tibetan Buddhists say the highest form of spiritual preparation for death is to recognize the self-inflicted qualities of our miseries, of our difficulties, of our unanswered spiritual longings. And that if we are able to do that, then we will be able to recognize, as the Buddha recognizes under the Bo tree, the demons of fear and desire that Mara, the king of the demons, says to him. Now, not everybody knows the story, so let me do quick précis of the Buddhist story. Buddha's born as this golden child. His father wants him to be a world ruler, a chakravartin, as it would be said in Sanskrit. And so he raises him up in the palace, meeting his every whim and interest and not allowing him to have any knowledge of illness, old age, or death. Anybody gets old, they get banished from the palace. He never sees anything that isn't neat. So he grows up with this existential sense that something is wrong. He's a little bit like Jim Carrey in that movie, The Truman Show. The Truman Show is like the castle of the young Siddhartha. And he finally gets his charioteer, who many people say, like so many other charioteers in the Hindu tradition, is an incarnation of Vishnu, who's come for the purpose of breaking this illusion. So he gets his charioteer to take him out into the streets, and he sees old people and sick people and dead bodies, and he goes, "What's going on here?" And the charioteer says, "Hey, you've led a protected life. This is how it really is." And in that moment, all his illusions about being king and owning the world and all that stuff just fall away. He says, "This is the human condition. Whoa, I have been misled." And so he deserts his responsibilities. He abandons his wife and children in some versions, and goes off into the woods and becomes this Hindu mendicant. He tries every meditative technique they have to offer, and he's more ferocious about following them than any of them are. And in Southeast Asia, there is a tradition of Buddhist art that shows the Buddha in his pre-Buddha state practicing all these austerities, and they are statues of the traditional Buddha sitting in the traditional position, and he looks like an Auschwitz victim. It's a skeleton just barely covered with stretched skin. They're quite extraordinary statues, quite extraordinary religious objects. Anyway, he goes down this road of discipline further than anybody else has gone, and his problems are not answered. And he's sitting there one day, frustrated with not just physical life, but spiritual life. And a young cowgirl, a woman who tends cows, comes along, who's actually Sarasvati, who has incarnated for the purpose of this moment. Her whole life circles around walking down the road with a jar of milk and coming on the emaciated Buddha and looking at him and go, "Oh, honey, you ought to have something to eat." She gives him the milk, and he drinks the milk and realizes a middle path must be found, and the only way to find it is to look inward and see what's there. This discipline of the body doesn't work. It's got to be another kind of discipline. So he sits there, and he begins to meditate and look into his own being the way Brahma does to create the world. In some sense, the world is being created anew, being reborn, in the same way that Brahma brings it forth to begin with. Brahma is the only thing there is. He's curious. Since he's the only thing there is, he looks into his own being to see what's there, and everything flows out as a result. The same thing essentially happens for Buddha. Now, part of the Hindu tradition is this charming notion, at least I find it charming, that whenever anybody, an animal, a human being, a spirit, a tree demon, whoever, that whoever begins this interior journey and begins to get close to the core creates heat in the thrones of the gods and goddesses. And they heat up like pancake griddles so they can't stay seated. And they pop up and look around and go, "Who's doing that? Who's doing that?" And they look down and they go, "Oh, it's that lunatic prince who's doing that, the one who gave it all up." And at that point, Mara, the king of the demons, says, "The bottom is going to fall out of the used car market if this lad succeeds, and my fortunes will be significantly reduced. This can't be allowed to happen." So he whistles up his sons, and he says, "Go frighten him. Go scare him so that he'll slip away from this meditative effort that he's got." So the sons arrive, and I think it is important not just to talk about what they do in terms of what traditional Hindus were most afraid of, but to think of the things that we're most afraid of. It is as though they show up and they throw world economic collapse at him. And they throw the AIDS epidemic at him. And they throw being betrayed by the one who loves you best at him. And they throw all the worst stuff at him. And in the traditional stories, all of these terrible things come into his auric space and turn into lotus blossoms and fall to the ground. And the sons are confounded. They have never failed in this before. And they try and try and try, and they can't do it. He looks at them and he says, "Don't I know you from someplace? Yes, I know you from someplace. You are merely projections of my disordered thought forms. Take a number. I will deal with you later." And they are defeated, and they go back to Dad, and they go, "Well, gee, Dad, I hope you'll remember that we've never failed before, and I hope you'll take that into consideration because we failed." And Mara is furious, and he says, "How can you allow this to happen? It's your inheritance that is at stake here." And he goes, "You're a bunch of bums. Get out of my sight." And he calls up his daughters, and he says, "Well, you know, I don't like to disturb you, but your brothers have all failed." And they laugh. And he goes, "Yeah, I know. It was bound to happen. But this prince is messing everything up. Fear doesn't work. We got to try desire. And you girls are the queens of desire, so go lay it on him." And they arrive, and they offer him MacArthur grants and world peace and a cure to AIDS and an end to racism, and someone who loves him best, who he loves best. They offer him everything. And he looks at them and goes, "Don't I know you from someplace?" "Yes, like your brothers, you are merely projections of my own disordered thought forms. Get away from me. Stop bothering me. Take a number." And Buddha acquires his first follower in that moment, who, like Jesus after the resurrection, the first people to connect with him and know the truth are the women. And the first person to recognize the divinity of this figure is one of the daughters of the demon Mara, the queen of lust. And she recognizes that her own salvation is at hand, and she becomes his first acolyte. And the story rolls on from there. Now, in the same fashion that Christians are urged to imitate the life of Christ, Buddhists are urged to imitate the life of Buddha. And this central place in the life of Buddha, meditating to the point where all the fears and all the desires are recognized as unconscious, unbidden projections of the meditator's own disordered thought forms, is the key to salvation in the Hindu Buddhist tradition. So the Tibetan Buddhists come along and they know about how dreams work, and they believe that what happens after we die is that we enter our dream worlds without the option of waking up again. And they go, "What we need is the ability to recognize that we are dreaming while it's going on." And that is, of course, the technical definition of lucid dreaming. So the cultivation of lucid dreaming in the Tibetan Buddhist tradition becomes, in many people's view, not too surprisingly my own included, the most important spiritual discipline that is available. Because if you can train yourself to dream lucidly while you are in the body, then you will be in a better position to recognize the dream of the afterlife for what it is, that it is a dream, it is insubstantial. The 19th century Sanskritists translated the word as void. I don't think it's the best translation, but it's what we're stuck with. To recognize that it is not what it appears to be. And so what every Tibetan Buddhist is urged to do, and there are a number of extremely effective practices in the tradition, is to cultivate the ability to recognize the dream when it happens and to make the transition from waking to sleep and dreaming and back into the waking world again without any diminution of conscious self-awareness. Now, little footnote about Carl Jung. Carl Jung heard about this and delivered himself of the opinion that it was all fantasy and impossible. Bam, thank you for playing. No. And the problem with that for contemporary Jungians is that they don't like when Carl was wrong. So they don't even like to talk about lucid dreaming, because in the course of talking about it, you have to, if you're going to be honest, to acknowledge this comment that Jung delivered himself of, which is clearly not true. All these lucid dreaming practices are in fact possible. My own research suggests that you don't even have to believe the philosophical and religious tradition out of which it grows. It will happen faster if you believe in the actual concreteness of the religious narrative that it goes with, but you don't need to. If you do what the Tibetans tell you to do, with seriousness, you will get lucid. That's how it works. And these practices are all known and available to us. There are some secret ones, but even they are getting known more and more often. The Dalai Lama himself made the point with the celebration of the chakra mandala, which used to be a thing that only happened once every 10 years. And now the Dalai Lama does it every year because he says we haven't got decades anymore. Technology has speeded up the pace of history, and this energy and this knowledge must be spread as far as it can be spread, as often as possible. We can't stay with this tradition of once a decade. And that is essentially what is informing the revelation of these other secrets. They are too important for the salvation of the species and the planet to be reserved for an elite who've already been trained. The whole thing is a metaphor, and it is a sacred metaphor, and it has to do with how our fate rests not on large geopolitical forces outside ourselves that we cannot comprehend, let alone control and influence, that in fact, history is as much of a projection as our dreams are. And the more people there are who begin to recognize the nature of the dream world, it is inevitable that that realization will be followed by a recognition that the seemingly concrete physical waking world is also created of projection. The same way the dream world is, that it is another variety of dreaming, and that as our consciousnesses evolve, the circumstances in which we find ourselves evolve also. And that a familiarity with what we would call the archetypes is immensely helpful in that task. Now, one can certainly encounter the archetypes in very satisfactory ways out of any of the world's religious traditions, shamanism included. Christianity stands among the world religions in celebrating the sacredness of willing sacrifice, not above them. And Christian triumphalism and claiming the cross as exclusive Christian property is a mistake. Let us look at the cross for a moment, deconstruct it. It's two vectors. It's a horizontal vector and a vertical vector. And the archetypal significance of the horizontal vector is Middle Earth, eye level, where we live. And over on the left side, there's all the stuff in the world that we don't like. And over on the right side, there's all the stuff that we love. And we scan back and forth across the horizontal vector regularly. Then there's the vertical vector. It points up into the bright heavens, and it points down into the dark psyche. And where they cross, where they coincide and cannot be distinguished from one another, the center is where all authentic religious and spiritual experiences take place. Successful believing Muslims are crucified on that archetypal cross. That cross belongs to everybody. And to claim it as the exclusive property of me and my friends, because it really does make me feel good, is ultimately a mistake. I can say my tradition, the tradition which allows me to approach this truth, is Christian, and I love it, and I will never not love it. That seems like a perfectly reasonable stance to take. But to say, well, this is really the highest way and the only way and the best way, and everybody else better get with the program. Christianity must spread itself across the world for a world salvation to take place. Bam. Thank you for playing. No, that's not how it works. And even the most gentle expression of that conviction is limiting. And what is required is what is symbolized by lucid dreaming. What is required is recognizing what our circumstances actually are when we are awake. And as we recognize that, it will be spontaneously reflected in the dream world, in my experience, by recognizing with more clarity what our circumstances are when we are asleep, namely that we are dreaming. I am much more interested in spontaneous lucidity these days than I am in the lucidity that is the product of meditative effort. because there is a danger in approaching lucidity through meditative effort. There's an invitation to treat it like a machine and to say, this is a really good machine. And if I just turn the machine on, the machine will take care of my problems. If I just cultivate lucidity, being lucid itself will solve my problems. Once again, Beckett's last couplets at the end of the second act of T.S. Eliot's Murder in the Cathedral speak this shadow truth more eloquently than any other source that I am aware of. After this great struggle, Beckett turns to the audience for the first time. Prior to that, it's looked like an ordinary play, and we're all disembodied observers watching this thing happen. At the end of the second act, Beckett turns directly to the audience and involves the audience over the footlights. And he says to them, "The last temptation is the greatest treason, to do the right thing for the wrong reason." Let me say it again. The last temptation is the greatest treason, to do the right thing for the wrong reason. And to think that just because it's the right thing, it's all that has to be done, is a profound psycho-spiritual mistake. And the Tibetan Buddhists themselves make it all the time. It's not like they have invented a machine that keeps them from making that mistake. They make that mistake all the time. But they also have this piece to offer us about the nature of lucid dreaming. That lucid dreaming symbolically reflects a deeper understanding of the true reality of the moment, namely that I am asleep and dreaming. And that understanding begins then to blossom in the midst of waking experience. Oh, I thought this was an objective, separate world from me. I realize it's not. There may be an objective separate world out there somewhere, but I'm incapable of seeing it because I plaster my projections over it all the time. And it's important to remember, projection is not something we do on purpose. It is an unconscious act. And as we project on the world, it becomes a dream. If you define the dream as an apparently separate world created by our projections, it seems to me to be a reasonable definition, not the only one, but among others. If you look at that as a definition of dreaming, then sooner or later, the realization comes, ooh, that's just as true of my waking life as it is of my sleeping life. The Buddhists are right. It's all a dream. And what is required is to wake up. What is required is to do what the Buddha did under the Bo tree, to recognize desire and fear as projections of my own disordered thought forms. I would offer you an understanding of the current worldwide global financial crisis. It is a projection of our own disordered thought forms. It has all to do with money. And we invented money. Money is our servant, not our ruler. And we have, forgotten. So having invented money once, it's clearly time to invent it again. I would also offer you another view of the ministry of Jesus. People say that he got crucified because he said he was God and blah, blah. I don't think so. I think he was crucified because he was preaching the Jubilee. And he was saying to the Jews, it's time to forgive all debt. This is a commandment of my Father. And it's way past time. We need to abolish debt. All debt needs to be forgiven. And we need to begin fresh again in the presence of the divine. And I believe that that's what got him killed. I don't think the Romans cared particularly. The evidence is very strong that they perceived the Jews to just be a pain in the nether regions. They didn't really care about them that much. They were a client state of the empire. Not a very big deal. But the forgiveness of debt? That's like Mara saying, oh my Lord, if Buddha succeeds, my entire empire is finished. And there were enough intelligent Romans, I believe Pilate probably being one of them, to realize, I can't let this happen on my watch. My masters will be really annoyed. And we all know what they do when they're really annoyed. So I'm going to wash my hands in public. I'm going to let the Jews do my dirty work for me. That makes more sense to me than all this heavy breathing about theology, which it's so clear the Romans don't even care about. You know, they've even gotten used to their idiot emperors becoming gods and drinking with each other and going, can you believe that idiot's a god now? I mean, I knew him. And, you know, I'm not making this up. You look at the literature and there it is. And it is selective reading of the literature that creates the problems that we face. For example, if you look at the actual utterances ascribed to Jesus throughout the New Testament, and particularly the four Gospels, and you write them all down on a page and you have one list that has to do with unjust distribution of the wealth, and you have another column for sexual misdeeds, you're going to have pages about the inequitable distribution of the wealth, and you're going to have one line about sexual misconduct, and that line consists of go and sin no more. That's it. And yet you can go to any frantically fearful Christian church and listen, and you would think that Jesus spent his whole life inveighing against sexual misconduct. The evidence is there. If you go to the sources yourself, it is impossible to maintain the current understanding, which is certainly necessary to get into the country club, but which is not true. And we need the Jubilee again. And we need it not only at the economic level, we need it at the theological level. And the way to begin to rebuild one's relationship with the divine that is absolutely available to everyone is increased serious attention to the dream. And if I am a true Christian, my dreams will bring me to that tradition as the best way for me to make this connection. And if I realize that it's all a little larger even than the planet, I need to familiarize myself with other traditions. Thank you.